We're going to continue our Bible series today. We've been taking a journey through the Bible since way back in last year. We started at the beginning in Genesis, and we've been working our way through the Old Testament or the Old Covenant or what you call the Hebrew Scriptures. And we made it, you know, into the time period of the Kingdom of Israel after Israel came out of slavery in Egypt and were brought into the Promised Land. And they, at first, they were just a confederation of tribes joining together, and then eventually they decided they needed to be more unified for strength, and they became a kingdom. And we had their first king, Saul, and then David, and David's son, Solomon. And after Solomon, we took a little break around the holidays and then studied some other books for a few weeks in the early part of this year. But last week, we went back to that part of history, and we started a little series within our big series, our journey through the Bible. We started a little series last week that we're calling Thrones. And it picks up after Solomon's death and what happens to the kingdom next. I want to remind you about an important character that we met back in Solomon's reign and again last week, because he's the center of today's story. And I must tell you up front, today's story is not a very happy one. It's not a very positive story, okay? And a lot of times there's tough stories to read about in history and in Scripture, but today there's just not a lot of good in the story. It's just sad. It ends sad. It's full of all sorts of wild stuff that's just going to be like, wow. But I believe there's a truth that we can take with us at the end. I'm going to send it home with us today. But we need this story because it's an important character to understand the arc of this part of the Bible. And so we're just going to go down this dark path together, and I'm going to trust that you'll bear with me on that. The character we met a few times, his name is Jeroboam. Let me remind you about Jeroboam just a little bit here. Jeroboam was a young man who was quickly becoming somebody in Israel. King Solomon saw the potential of Jeroboam's leadership, and he promoted him in the kingdom to authority, to regional authority. Jeroboam was, you know, just helping oversee things under King Solomon's administration. And Jeroboam was going places. He was a budding young leader on the rise. One day, as he's heading back across the field for some reason, he walks through the field and a prophet of God named Ahijah meets Jeroboam in the middle of the field. And Ahijah tells him that because of the direction that Solomon was going in his later years and where his son would go after him, that the kingdom of Israel was going to be shattered into two pieces and never be reunited again, and that Jeroboam would someday be made the king of the majority of the tribes of Israel. Now that had to be the most ludicrous conversation Jeroboam could have ever imagined. He was not royalty, he was not royal family. There was nothing about his life that would suggest that that was in his cards. He was just a guy who was gonna be something, but you know how it is. You're like, I know I'm good, but I'm not that good. You know, I got opportunities, but I don't have those opportunities. But Jeroboam is told the impossible is gonna happen. The kingdom will shatter into two, and you will be king one day. Now, Jeroboam is not a religious man or a God-fearing man, but he hears that. And eventually, the king, Solomon, tries to hunt him down, so Jeroboam leaves the country, stays gone until Solomon's death, and comes back for the coronation of his son. When King Rehoboam, Solomon's son, became king, Jeroboam and others show up to the coronation ceremony to ask him to change his father's policies, because his dad was too rough. And they said, lighten it up. And he didn't appreciate them spoiling his coronation party with their policy requests. So he is harsh with them and says, I will be harder on you than my dad was. To which the nation's like, okay, well then, peace out, dude. And they left. They split off right then. They broke away. And 10 of the tribes said, you know what? Rehoboam and Solomon's son and David's grandson, you can have your home tribe of Judah. Judah and even little Benjamin above you that's in fragments can stay with you. But the other 10 tribes, we're going to break off and form our own nation. And we're of no more part of you. And they did. They were out of there. And so at this point, the kingdom is splintered. And the people up north asked Jeroboam, sure enough, just like the prophet said years earlier, they asked Jeroboam to be their king. And what a crazy ride he's had. But Jeroboam is instantly afraid the people might change their mind eventually, especially when they go down south to Judah to visit Jerusalem and worship at the temple. He was afraid they'd change their mind, so he decides to convince them that we don't do that anymore. And so he made two golden calves. He had his people make two golden calves. Jeroboam's not a religious man anyhow, but he makes two golden calves and says to the people, these golden calves are the gods that brought you out of Egypt, out of slavery, which is just ludicrous. They should have laughed him out of the room, but he sold it to them. I mean, it's a silly idea in all the ways you can think about it, right? Like, if your God is something that you can literally make with your own hands, you got a pretty puny God, right? Instead of worshiping the God who made all things, he said let's worship something we can make with our hands. It's like worshiping, you know, something in nature instead of the God who created everything. And so created the things that we worship. So Jeroboam said, these golden calves are your new gods. And Israel should have said, no way, Jose. But they were so mad at Rehoboam. They were so mad at the southern kingdom that they said, you know what, we're good with that. We're going to break the nation in two. They actually killed one of Rehoboam's key officials, murdered him. And they decided to throw their religion, they threw their faith out the window. They threw the baby out with the bathwater. They said, if you're bad and we don't like you, we're going to reject you, your kingdom, your politics, and your faith. And they threw the whole thing away. Instead, we're going a different direction. And they worshiped the golden calves. And Jeroboam made regular old people become, who wants to be a new priest? You know, the old priest went back to Jerusalem. Who wants to be a priest in this new religion? I'll be it. Okay. And anyone who wanted to be, got to be priest of the golden calf. Got little hats and robes to go with it, I guess. I don't know. And they formed a whole new silly religion just to keep people away from going back to the God of Israel because they're mad. They're mad at Rehoboam. And that's where we left off last week. Jeroboam was actually going to one of the golden calves was in the city of Bethel. The other was in the city of Dan. And he was going there to offer sacrifices on an altar to worship the golden calf. He didn't even believe in the golden calf, as we'll see. He just was trying to get people to say, do this. So he's going there to do his thing there in Bethel. And that's where we left off. And that's where we pick up the story today. 1 Kings chapter 13 and verse 1. At the Lord's command, a man of God from Judah, down south in Judah. By the way, let me just quickly say something about this. The kingdom, when it divided, never reunited again. And so just as you know, from now on, the one kingdom down south is called the Southern Kingdom or the Kingdom of Judah. You should know this. And up north, those tribes become the Northern Kingdom or the Kingdom of Israel. And that's a little confusing because at one time it was all Israel before they splintered off. So depending on where you're reading, that might not make sense. But once the break happened, the northern tribes kept the name Israel or the northern kingdom. And the southern kingdom, where David, King David's lineage came from, became known as the southern kingdom or Judah from that point on. Just so you understand that. So a man of God comes up from Judah, goes up to Bethel in the northern kingdom, and he arrives there just as Jeroboam was approaching the altar to burn incense to the golden calves. And then, at the Lord's command, he shouted, "O altar, altar, this is what the Lord says. A child named Josiah will be born into the dynasty of David. On you he will sacrifice the priests from the pagan shrines who come here to burn incense, and human bones will be burned on you." Now this is a crazy thing to say. It's pretty drastic stuff. And it hasn't happened yet. It won't happen for generations and generations later. But he's prophesying that somebody, this person named Josiah, a child will be born and will do these drastic things up north at this altar. And when he said that, no one who was listening to this man of God, this prophet, no one who was hearing him say that would be alive to see that happen. It was a future thing that he was predicting. But when it would come to pass one day, people would take note, oh wow, that was something going on there. But because it wouldn't happen in their day, it says in verse 3 that same day, the man of God gave a sign to prove his message. He said, "The Lord has promised to give you this sign today. This altar will split apart, and its ashes will be poured out on the ground." The ashes on the altar that have been burned here are going to pour out when the altar splits in half. Get ready. Well, when King Jeroboam heard this man of God speaking against the altar at Bethel, he pointed at him and shouted, "Seize that man," you know, arrest him. But instantly, the king's hand became paralyzed. in that position, and he couldn't pull it back. Can you imagine how awkward it would be if your body froze up? And he's like, sees that man, and then he paralyzes in place, and he can't move, and he can't retract his arm. Like, what's going on with my body? And this is a moment happening here. It says, at that same time, a wide crack appeared in the altar, and the ashes poured out just as the man of God predicted. That's pretty drastic. Right then, the altar cracks, ashes poured out. Whoa. His hand's still stuck. And so the king cried out to the man of God, please ask the Lord your God to restore my hand. So the man of God prayed to the Lord, and the king's hand was restored, and he could move it again. And you'd like to think that this is one of those light bulb moments for Jeroboam. You'd like to think so. You know, you'd like to have thought that even though he wasn't a religious man and didn't think he believed in or cared about God at all, you'd like to have thought that when a prophet told a young Jeroboam he'd be king someday, unlikely, and now he is, he'd be like, huh, maybe there's something to this whole thing. Maybe I'll follow the direction of God, because God had made a covenant with Jeroboam in that field back when he was a young man. We say the word covenant. That word covenant is a fancy word in the scriptures for a deal or a contract. Usually God would come along and say, I'm going to bless you just because. Now, if you'll do this afterwards, I will do this for you in exchange. So it's kind of like a layered thing. I'm good to you just because. If you'll follow me, I'll bless you this way. And God made a covenant with Jeroboam like he did with David when Jeroboam was a young man. But Jeroboam didn't believe it. But you'd think that when he became the king, he'd be like, oh, wow. There really is something to this whole thing. Who knew? And I'm going to follow or believe now. But he still didn't. You'd think that after the altar splits into two and the ashes are poured out right in front of his face, or when his hand gets frozen into place, it's pretty dramatic, you know, or is healed after prayer from the person who he pointed at, that now he'd say, I see the light. But no. It says in verse 33, but even after this, even after all that he has seen since his young days in that field till that dramatic moment just now, even after this, Jeroboam did not turn from his evil ways. He continued to choose priests from the common people. He appointed anyone who wanted to become a priest for the pagan shrines. He just said, who cares? And it says in verse 34 that this became a great sin and resulted in the utter destruction of Jeroboam's dynasty from the face of the earth. We say it so often here. When we forsake God, when we say, I don't want anything to do with God, we are in danger of forsaking the practices that God teaches us, which the one who made the world knows how things work, who made the laws of nature and the world says this is how you should do things. His ways are the best practices. And when we abandon God, we tend to abandon best practices, unless we don't, because we grab those but we reject God. But at some point, when God gets pushed away, eventually best practices do as well. And Jeroboam's just shoved the whole thing away. And it's going to be a death spiral for his family going forward. And so, here's the crazy part. We're going to continue the story, and it's going to get tragic. Before we continue the story, I want to make a comparison to you. Let me nerd out for a minute here. I want to make a comparison for you between Jeroboam and the famous King David a couple generations ago. King David and Jeroboam, they're similar, and yet they have one distinct difference. Can I draw the picture for you? Back in King David's day, when he was a young man, minding his own business out in the field, watching his sheep, a prophet from God named Samuel shows up and says, you're going to be the future king. David wasn't in kingly line. He wasn't related to a king. He's just a young man in a field. He said, you'll be the future king. Just like a prophet of God named Ahijah met Jeroboam in a field and said, you're not part of the royal family, but you're going to be future king. And young David back in the day, David was a rising star in his kingdom. He went to the palace and played music there because he was very talented with music. He went on the battlefield and was victorious with the Philistines. And his star was rising. Just like Jeroboam, his star was rising. Solomon had promoted Jeroboam in his kingdom like Saul promoted David. And the people loved David and the people loved Jeroboam when they were young. But then back in David's day, remember David's day? King Saul got jealous of David and insecure about David's rising star, and so he tried to kill him. Just like Solomon became jealous of Jeroboam when he heard this and tried to kill him. And I remember how David, when he was a young man, had to run for his life and leave the country and go, moved into the land of the Philistines and stayed there until King Saul died for safety. And when Saul died, he returned to Israel. The same way Jeroboam had to flee the country from Solomon, and he went to Egypt and stayed there until Solomon died and he came back. David and Jeroboam's stories are so similar, it's eerie. But that's where the similarities stop. When David, who was a young man who had faith in God, who wrote songs to God even as a young shepherd, when David became king and God gave him what he promised he would give him many years later, David was so all in on God that he began to do all these things to promote God's name, to bring the people closer to God with him. He began to bring the tabernacle up to the new capital city of Jerusalem. He wanted to build a temple, but he said, you know what, we're going to wait until the next generation, God's word, to do that. But he brought the tabernacle, he brought the ark of the Lord there. He wrote more songs. He hired musicians to write songs and put a whole song book together called the Book of Psalms. We still have that book today. And David just not only followed God, he drew the nation closer to God through his leadership. But Jeroboam, who is so much like David in their story and how their story arc went, when he became king, he didn't do any of that. He looked at all that God had given him and said, I just don't buy it. I mean, I can't explain it, but I don't want anything to do with it. I'm not a God person. Nah. He pushed it away. And not only did he push it away, he brought the people away from God with him. He said, because I'm afraid of the people. It's interesting because he's worried they're going to go down to Jerusalem to worship God there and return to Israel, to the temple that David helped get building. And so he's not going to go worship God at the temple. He's not a religious man. But he's afraid that the religious nuts in his nation, you know, the religious crazies up there, are going to go back in their pathetic need for faith, are going to go down to Jerusalem and do their thing. And so to keep them from returning to Jerusalem, he says, let's make these golden calves. I don't believe in them either, but maybe if you'll worship them with me, it'll placate your need for some kind of religion or faith, and you'll stay away from Jerusalem, and it will be better for me politically. So while David and David were similar, David took his throne, thanked God, and brought the people closer to God. When Jeroboam got on the throne, he still had no use for God in his life, and here's the worst part, he used his leadership to pull the entire nation away from God. He used his leadership to pull everyone away from their faith, and they were willing to do it because they were mad at the politics down south, so they said, we'll do it. And his influence was not just to walk away from God's covenant with him, but to pull an entire nation away from their faith. It's a sad story. Well, anyhow, what happens next is a tragic piece, and I want to read it for you here. In 1 Kings 14, verse 1 says, at that time, Jeroboam's son Abijah became very sick. Now, when I say very sick, I mean terminally sick. Abijah, by the way, the word Abijah sounds like Ahijah the prophet. That's just English translation stuff. They're different people. Abijah, his son, becomes deathly ill. He's dying. That's very common, by the way. You know, the mortality rate of ancient times was so much higher than we experience in modern medicine in times like today. But back then, I mean, infant mortality, childhood, adolescent, and beyond was just so common. And Jeroboam has got a son who's dying. He's very sick. He doesn't know what to do, but he doesn't have faith, and he doesn't believe in anything. But he wants to find out some answers. So in verse 2, Jeroboam told his wife, disguise yourself so that no one will recognize you as my wife, and then go to the prophet Ahijah at Shiloh. That's the man who told me I would become king a long time ago. Met me in the field. Go to see Ahijah and Shiloh. Now, Jeroboam didn't go himself, perhaps because he doesn't believe, or perhaps because he's the king, he's too busy. He definitely doesn't want anyone in his kingdom seeing him go to a prophet from God when he's convinced the whole nation to quit believing in that God, quit going to that temple, quit being a part of that system. How can you then turn around and go to a prophet in there and say, I want your help because I'm in, you know, my family? So he's not going to go, but he wants his wife to go. And he says, I want you to disguise yourself because I don't want anyone to know that even my wife is going there, because that sends the wrong message that we believe that nonsense. But I want you to go find out what's going to happen. So would you go disguise yourself and visit the prophet Ahijah? He says to her, take him a gift of 10 loaves of bread, some cakes, a jar of honey, and ask him what's going to happen to the boy. He doesn't say pray for the boy. He just asks him what's going to happen. He seems to be clairvoyant. He somehow knew that I'd be king someday, however he knew that. Just ask him what's going to happen. I'm curious. And I feel bad for Jeroboam's wife. I don't know if she was a good person or not. The family seems pretty terrible through history as you read about them. But either way, I feel bad for her because she's like, I don't want to go. He's like, well, you go. Disguise yourself and go. So she leaves her son, who she knows is dying, and she'll probably never see him again. She'll probably never get back in time to see him. So she says her final goodbyes in case she doesn't make it back. says her farewells, leaves her sick child, and she goes on this errand for her husband and all the way to visit Ahijah the prophet in disguise. Verse 4 says, when Jeroboam's wife, she went to Ahijah's house at Shiloh. He was an old man now, and he could no longer see. But the Lord had told Ahijah that Jeroboam's wife will come here pretending to be someone else. She will ask you about her son, for he is very sick. Give her the answer I give you. So when Ahijah heard her footsteps at the door, he called out, "Come in, wife of Jeroboam. Why are you pretending to be someone else?" Then he told her, "I have bad news for you." Now, it's interesting is, you know, one of those things where one of those weird coincidences happens when she's at the door in disguise, and all of a sudden this guy inside who turns out to be blind anyhow says, "I know you're at the door. I know who you are. And I know you're dressed up." You know, okay, I'm listening. And she comes in and he says, "I have some bad news for you." And he proceeds to give her a message for her husband, because her husband's not listening. So I'm going to take this opportunity, since you're here, to say, take this message home to your husband from God. He says, "Give your husband Jeroboam this message from the Lord, the God of Israel. I promoted you from the ranks of the common people, and I made you ruler over my people Israel." He says, "Come on, dude, I gave it all to you. You know that. You didn't have that coming. I made a deal with you." He says, "I ripped the kingdom away from the family of David, and I gave it to you. But you have not been like my servant David, who obeyed my commands and followed me with all his heart and always did whatever I wanted." Now, here's the crazy part about David. If you know the story of David, David was not perfect back in the day. David was a good king, but David did something really bad in the peak of his reign. That's the kind of thing that you get canceled over forever. And David, you know, wasn't always doing right. But here's the thing about David. Even when David got off track, whenever someone corrected David, he always took it. He acknowledged his wrongs. He repented and changed his behavior. And he always accepted the consequences and went forward from there. So even after David's worst days, part of his faith journey was getting back up when he fell down and getting back on track spiritually, even though he went off the rails for a while. And that was good enough for God. God's, the legacy that David leaves behind in history is that he was a man after God's own heart. And Ahijah says to Jeroboam's wife, "You guys were so similar in your story, but you're nothing like each other. Nothing like David who followed me and listened and was approachable with correction when he needed it and brought the people to me through his leadership." The prophet says to Jeroboam's wife, "Tell your husband, God says, verse 9, you have done more evil than all who have lived before you. You've made other gods for yourself and have made me furious with your gold calves. You don't just have gone away. You've not only rejected me with all I've given you, you've pulled everyone else with you. You used your leadership and authority to pull everyone else with you that direction, far from their faith." And he says to him, "Since you have turned your back on me, I will bring disaster on your dynasty and will destroy every one of your male descendants, slave and free alike, anywhere in Israel. I will burn up your royal dynasty as one burns up trash until it is all gone. The members of Jeroboam's family who die in the city will be eaten by dogs, and those who die in the field will be eaten by vultures. I, the Lord, have spoken." If you're hearing that and saying, "Man, God's harsh." Okay, yeah. But let me just give you a little perspective here. Just a little perspective. Besides the fact that we're translating very old writing in form to understand what's being read, ancient prophets were always this way. In fact, not just ancient prophets, modern prophets. Anyone who is prophetic is almost always dramatic. Can we agree on that? People who are often prophetic are often dramatic. If something's good, it's not just good, it's sunshine and rainbows and kittens, you know, it's wonderful. If something's bad, it's like boom, and it's colorful doomsday punches. I mean, you gotta, your weapon is your words, your tool, your craft is your words. And so prophets would say things very dramatically to say, this is gonna happen. And so through all that lingo just now, here's what the prophet is saying to Jeroboam, to his wife, to tell Jeroboam in maybe a different way of saying it. He was saying, "Jeroboam, I gave it all to you. I didn't have to. And I told you, if you'll just follow me, I'll make a great deal, a great thing out of you. You didn't, and you not only have just rejected me, you pulled the whole nation away from me. And because you don't want me, I'm going to go ahead and step back. This is the big deal right here. God says, you don't want me? I'm stepping back. No little divine protection bubble for you. I'm going to let you experience what kingdoms experience all over the world, especially in ancient times. So common to read the history where people in kingdoms would experience assassinations and murders of their families and wiping out the competitors and wiping out the threats to the throne from the new guy who takes over. It's a bloody, bloody history of kings and kingdoms throughout the world's history. And God says, Jeroboam, I was going to bless you and take you along, but you don't want me? I'm going to step back and let you experience the real world in the lives of brutal kingdoms. It's all you, buddy. I'm just going to honor your request. And it's not going to go well. I'm going to be clairvoyant again, if you please. I'm going to tell you what happened before. When you were going to become king before you were, I'm going to tell you it's going to go bad for you in the end here. That's what's going to happen. And then he turns his attention to Jeroboam's poor wife. And Ahijah said to Jeroboam's wife what she feared the most, what she expected the most. He says, go on home, and when you enter the city, the child will die. You were right to say goodbye before you came because he's not going to make it till you get home. That's how it's unfortunately happening. He says to her, he says to his wife, all Israel will mourn for him, and they'll bury him. He is the only member of your family who will have a proper burial, for this child is the only good thing that the Lord, the God of Israel, sees in the entire family of Jeroboam. Very interesting statement. God says through the prophet, he's going to die, but honestly, he was the good one. He's the good one. And I'm going to let him have a peaceful passing, and we're going to honor him with a beautiful ceremony of burial. But the rest of your family won't be so fortunate, because what Jeroboam's doing is driving you off a cliff, and when it catches up to the rest of you, it's going to be bad. And he continues, he says a few more things, and then in verse 16, he says that God will abandon Israel because Jeroboam sinned and made Israel sin along with him. In other words, he says, you've not only gone this direction as a family, but you've taken all the people with you, so God's stepping away, saying, fine, you don't want me? Have at it. I'll let you experience the world without me. So Jeroboam's wife returned to Tirzah, and the child died just as she walked through the door of her home. And all Israel buried him and mourned for him as the Lord had promised through the prophet Ahijah. And from there on, things just get bad for Jeroboam's family. That was a peaceful reprieve time in his life. And from there, it just goes downhill and downhill and downhill as Jeroboam drives the people further down a dark path. And we're going to kind of skip. And I know I told you it's a heavy story today. I told you that at the front. But we're going to skip down because there's a few more kings that happen after Jeroboam, and I need you to know about them because they're going to take us to the story and where we're going next. So on the screen, I'm going to list to you the first six kings of the divided northern kingdom. The northern kingdom are Israel. The southern kingdom is Judah. The northern kingdom's first six kings are on the screen. It's Jeroboam, Jeroboam's son Nadab, briefly. Then a man named Baasha takes over. Then his son Elah, briefly. And then Zimri. And then Omri. Those are the first six kings. And I'm going to take a few minutes with you before we're done and read you a couple verses about each one of them really quickly. And we're going to skip through six kings today because we need to understand Jeroboam's legacy. We need to understand where it takes us next, because after these guys comes a real spicy show later on. So let's start with Jeroboam's son Nadab. In 1 Kings 15:25, it says, Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, he began to rule over Israel in the second year of King Asa's reign in Judah. Now, Asa is in the southern kingdom. There's Rehoboam, and then another son, and then a grandson of Rehoboam's named Asa would be the king eventually. And this all happens in the same time. So sometimes when the book's being written here, it will mark one kingdom to the other by who's reigning on the other side of the border. And what year are they in their reign? So Jeroboam passes away. His son takes over in the second year of King Asa. And Nadab, this young king, reigned in Israel for only 2 short years. But he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He followed the example of his father, check it out, continuing the sins that Jeroboam committed. No, that Jeroboam had led Israel to commit. Not that Jeroboam had just done himself. and saying, I don't need God, I don't care about that stuff, but that Jeroboam led everyone under his leadership to commit as well, pulling them away from their God and their faith. He continued on that same path. And here's where the tragedies begin to roll in. Verse 27, then Baasha, son of Ahijah, from the tribe of Issachar, plotted against Nadab and assassinated him while he and the Israelite army were laying siege to the Philistine town of Gibbethon. Just a quick funny note to me. The Philistine town of Gibbethon. I know nothing about Gibbethon in history, but it has to be like the luckiest city. Every time Israel up north kept trying to conquer it, they were trying to go over and conquer the city and expand their borders. And every time they went there, something would go down. So here they're over trying to siege the Philistine town of Gibbethon. And while they're there, the king is there, Jeroboam's son Nadab, and this guy Baasha, while they're out there in the battlefront in their tents or whatever, he assassinates him and takes over the throne. Just right there in the middle of the siege. It says that Baasha killed Nadab in the third year of King Asa's reign in Judah, and he became the next king of Israel. Check this out, verse 29. He immediately slaughtered all the descendants of King Jeroboam so that not one of the royal family was left, just as God had the Lord had foretold or prophesied or predicted or promised concerning Jeroboam by the prophet Ahijah from Shiloh. It happened just like he said it would happen. This guy wipes out the entire royal family. They're gone. I mean, not just the king, but anyone who could be a future part of the throne. He just annihilates. It's a sad story in history too often. But now Baasha's the king. He lives and he eventually dies. And when Baasha dies, it says his son Elah, in chapter 16 and verse 8, Elah, son of Baasha, began to rule over Israel in the 26th year of King Asa's reign in Judah. He reigned in the city of Tirzah for 2 years. I didn't mention this earlier. Some of you don't care. But Jeroboam started off in the capital city of Shechem. They moved the capital to Tirzah, and that's where people are reigning now. And Elah, the son of Baasha, has a short 2-year reign in the city of Tirzah. What happens next is another crazy story. Verse 9, then Zimri, who commanded half of the royal chariots, made plans to kill him. One day in Tirzah, Elah, the king, was getting drunk at the home of Arza, the supervisor of the palace. He's with his buddy who runs the palace having a party. They're getting drunk and hammered. And Zimri walked in and struck him down and killed him. This happened in the 27th year of King Asa's reign in Judah. And then Zimri became the next king. And Zimri immediately killed the entire royal family of Baasha, leaving not a single male child. He even destroyed distant cousins, distant relatives and friends. He said, I'm killing everyone who knows this guy, who likes this guy, to get rid of all the threats so that I'm the new guy. So it's just mutiny after mutiny and assassination after hostile takeover, one after another, going down. In verse 15, it says that Zimri began to rule over Israel in the 27th year of King Asa's reign in Judah. But his reign only lasted 7 days. That's shorter than our shortest former president, William Henry Harrison, right, from Indiana. I mean, he breaks that record right here, apparently. The armies of Israel, check this out. The armies of Israel were then attacking the Philistine town of Gibbethon. They're attacking Gibbethon again. And back home, Elah's drunk and gets assassinated. And it says that when the army heard that Zimri had committed treason and had assassinated the king, that very day they chose Omri, who was the commander of the army, to be the new king of Israel. So Omri led the entire army of Israel up from Gibbethon. They survive again to go back to the capital to attack Tirzah, Israel's capital. When Zimri saw that the city had been taken by the army, he went into the citadel of the palace and burned it down over himself and died in the flames. So he just took his own life rather than being captured. It says this in verse 19, so interesting. For he too had done what was evil in the Lord's sight. He followed the example of Jeroboam in the sins that he committed and led Israel to commit. What a strange thing. We're talking about Jeroboam. Folks, Jeroboam is long gone. We're several kings later. We're like kings who killed kings later right now. Jeroboam's family is all wiped out. Why is Jeroboam being talked about still? And keep his name out of your mouth. You know, I don't know what's going on here. I know, something's happening here. What's interesting is that even though we're generations and kingdoms removed from Jeroboam's legacy, actually from Jeroboam's family, Jeroboam's legacy is living on. And though he's long gone, future kings and kings after those kings will be known when they were bad kings by saying they were like old Jeroboam, who not only walked the wrong way in life, but brought the whole nation away from faith with him. His legacy would stick with him even after he was long gone, had nothing to do with the current throne. Interesting. He followed the example of Jeroboam in all the sins that he had committed, Jeroboam had committed, and that he had led the nation to commit with him. A few more verses and we're done reading for today. Let's look at verse 21. But now the people of Israel were split into two factions. Half the people tried to make Tibni, son of Ginath, their king. The other half supported General Omri. But Omri's supporters defeated the supporters of Tibni, so Tibni was killed, and Omri became the next king. And Omri began to rule over Israel in the 31st year of King Asa's reign in Judah. He reigned 12 years in all, six of them in Tirzah. I want you to catch this fact for later. Then Omri bought the hill that was known as Samaria from its owner Shemer for 150 pounds of silver. He built a city on it and called the city Samaria in honor of Shemer. That's important because this will become the new capital city, and it becomes a very famous part of Israel's history from that point on. Even by the time Jesus shows up, the people of that area are known as the Samaritans, and Samaria is an important area. But it all starts right here when the royal city is moved to this new location. And it says this in verse 25, Omri did what was evil in the Lord's sight, even more than any of the kings before him. He followed the example of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and all the sins that he committed and that he led the nation of Israel to commit as well. The people provoked the Lord to anger, the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, with their worthless handmade idols. And that's it. We just rushed through six kings, mostly talking about Jeroboam, and rushed through the next several. And we're going to stop there today because the guy that comes after Omri is going to get, we're going to be there for a little bit. It's going to be exciting tales from ancient times, okay? We'll get to that in a couple of weeks, not next week, but a couple of weeks. But for today, we just kind of come up to the end of these six kings, and I told you it's a tough story. It's not much happiness in this one today at all, is there? But it's an important piece of history to see not only Jeroboam's reign, how the kingdoms divided, but how the northern kingdom went off the rails, folks, and how it never, ever recovered. And what we see today is the legacy that Jeroboam left behind. And I want to leave you with a statement today, and we're going to give it to you and talk about it for a few moments, and then we're going to be done. I want to give you a statement to think about today, take home with you, think about it this week. It goes like this. Your choices determine your legacy. Now, let me be clear about something. Your choices don't determine whether God loves you or not. That's not what we're talking about. Jesus is going to show up later in the story, but not to Jesus yet in our journey, but we sing about him every week. We talk about it all the time. We preach about him many times. So we know the story of Jesus, the Christian message is that Jesus came to show us the heart of God for our eternal well-being. That Jesus comes to show us the good news. The gospel means good news, that we are loved, that God loves you. And that he would show us that he died to show us what forgiveness for our sins looks like, that he would rise again to show us that life is eternal. And God loves you. But here's the thing, God also gave us this world, created us in this world in love, and gave us free will and freedom of choice in love. And that includes the choice to make terrible choices and decisions. And there's consequences in the world that he made, the sandbox in which he placed us. There's natural laws and spiritual laws and physical laws of nature that we can run into and hurt ourselves with by choice. And though God loves us and he's redeemed us and eternity is our confidence through Jesus Christ, it's going to be good there. It is well with my soul. But in the meantime, down here, our legacy is shaped by our choices. Our choices determine our legacy. So I read a book some time ago. If you like self-help books or business coaching books or whatever, there's a book that a lot of people have read. It's like a staple of recent decades ago reading by a man named Stephen Covey, who wrote a book called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Has anyone ever read that book here today? Anyone read that book before? No, last time I had a couple of people read it. I recommend it. In that book, it's a great book, he talks about something that's so interesting, and I just want to share it with you. He says, you know, everyone ought to sit down and think about that when we die someday, there's going to be a eulogy given in our memory. What do you want people to say about you at your funeral when they eulogize you? And he says, don't just think about it. I want you to write it down. Now, no one ever does this. It's very hard to do this. Because I want you to sit down. If you're married, to think about when I die, if my spouse survives, what would I want my spouse to say about me at my memorial service? If I was to pass away, what would I want my parents to say or my children to say? What would I want my siblings to say? What would I want the people who work for me to say? And write it down. What you'd want, what you hoped they would say, what you want your legacy to be. Write it down. What you want people who work for you or who you work for or who you work with, your friends, your neighbors. What do you want different people who are there to celebrate your life to say about you in sincerity? What will you hope they would say? And it's an interesting exercise if you actually take the time to write it down. And I can say it to you and you could hear me and you could nod at what I'm about to say, but you don't know until you do it how powerful it is. That when you write it down, it shocks us every time. That it's never about money. It's never about power. It's almost always the things we think about or care about that day or how we treated others, about our relationships. That's always what is at center. It's always what's mattering. He says, write it down and know it. Because here's the thing, looking ahead, that's the legacy that we leave behind. And it may not be an epic kingdom legacy like Jeroboam. It may just be your circle of family and friends and a smaller group of people. But to those who go on after you, that's your legacy. And your choices determine your legacy. And the reason we need to think about that and look ahead is because if we're not, we'll have one desire, how we hope it will be, how we'll hope will be remembered, but then we're not oblivious and we're living a different way and there's no congruency. We need to make sure those two paths work together. Am I living in the way with the choices I make and the way I live that brings me to the outcome where people will say, this is who that person was to me. Your choices determine your legacy. And Jeroboam's choices, to just reject God, no matter what God did to get his attention, and offer him blessings, and just say, I don't care. I'm gonna walk their way and take everyone with me. And the legacy he left behind was generations later, for the rest of the kingdom of Israel, like, oh, this nation's bad. Just like old Jeroboam who made the whole nation sin. That was the legacy. What will ours be? Now, maybe you're sitting here today and you're saying, well, Arlen, that's a nice statement and all, but that's discouraging to me because I've already made bad choices. So I guess that's painful because my legacy. But here's the thing about that. You're building a legacy still today. I mentioned King David earlier. David had made bad choices. David messed up royally. He was royal, so it makes sense, royally. He messed up bad. And David, when he messed up, what did he do? He owned it. He acknowledged it. He repented from it, and he accepted the consequences, and he went forward back in his faith. See, it's so easy when we sometimes go off the rails and we mess up to say, that's just who I am. That's just who I am. I'm not cut out for that stuff. See, I flop because I'm a flopper. I just can't do it. This is just who I am. And to stay down when we get knocked down. But the people of history, both in the stories we're telling today, as well as you and me today and our contemporaries, the best stories are not perfect people, but people who live, make good choices, and when they don't make good choices, when we misstep, when we stumble, and when we fall, don't decide to stay down and say, this is my new identity. But instead say, I'm going to get back up, accept what comes from this, and push forward. That's part of your legacy. Some of your best legacy can come after failure. It's still a choice. And wherever you've been and wherever you are and wherever you're going, your choices are going to determine your legacy. What do we want that to be? So we'll stop there for today. We'll pick up the story. Well, Jeroboam's story is done. The next few kings are gone. What happens next is cool, but it's a couple weeks from now. But as we move forward into our series on thrones, I want to stop there and say this to you. Every moment of your life, you're loved by your God. Eternally, he has done all that he is required to redeem us. He has saved us. But while we walk this earth and work and breathe and interact and have relationships, we are making choices each day that determine our legacy. My question to you is simply this. What is your legacy? What choices are you making today? Is there congruency between what you want said and remembered about you and how you're walking today? Or is there incongruency? My suggestion for us today is think about that, write it down, and live with the end in mind. Let's pray.